Oh, hey, doll. Welcome to part four of the Moore's Murders. Still can't say it correctly. In last week's episode, we finished at the end of the trial when Ian Brady and Meyer Hindley were convicted of three counts of murder. They pleaded innocent throughout the whole trial and lied through their teeth, despite all the damning evidence that there was. They had claim tickets, whereabouts, voice recordings. They had eyewitness David Smith, who seen the whole thing, and they still said, nope, didn't do it. So Ian and Myra were given life sentences. They found Ian guilty of three murders of Leslie Ann Downey, John Kilbride, and Edward Evans, and Myra guilty of the murders of Leslie Ann Downey and Edward Evans. But we know that there were more murders, which we're going to get back into today. As soon as Ian and Myra were locked up, the public and the media they were sure there was more murders, and they tried to connect Ian and Myra to other missing children and teenagers from Manchester. One victim everyone was sure of was 3-year-old Stephen Jennings. Stephen was last seen in December 1962 and found 20 years later in a field. Although this murder did not turn out to be a Moore's killing, the true murderer was found guilty. His father. Jennifer Jennifer disappeared from a children's home in December 1964, aged 14. Ian Brady has reportedly admitted visiting the spot on the night she disappeared. And in 2010, Myra was said to have confessed to the sixth murder to a fellow prisoner. Further investigation revealed that, nope, Jennifer was actually alive and well. However, the truth will out. In 1985, Ian was being interviewed by a journalist. During the interview, Ian told him, yes, he had killed Pauline Reid and Keith Bennett. Shortly after this, in July of the same year, police paid Ian a wee visit. And just like he did in the trials, Ian denied everything. He denied telling the journalist this, and he denied the murder at all. Despite his denial, Manchester police reopened the investigation on the Saddleworth Moors, again asking the public to help identify the locations in the photographs. A few months later, Keith Bennett's mother, Winnie Johnson, wrote Myra a letter, begging for her to help police in finding her child's body. Winnie explained that she was a simple woman who worked in a hospital kitchen, a Christian, and knowing that Myra had regained her faith in prison, would Myra release her from this purgatory and show the nation that Myra is actually a loving and caring woman? Perhaps Winnie thought she could appeal to Myra's feminine, womanly, motherly soft side. Myra does not have that side. However, some people do disagree and think that Myra was genuinely moved by Winnie's letter. A few days after the letter, police visited Myra a little visit also. And just like Ian and just like in the trial, Myra denied everything. But she said she would have another look at those photos on the Moors to identify spots she had visited with Ian. I mean, like, if she was genuinely moved, I think she would have admitted to her involvement. I just think she wanted to admire her frazzled fucking blonde hair from 20 years ago and, like, have pictures to remind her, like, think she is getting off on these pictures. But eventually Myra agreed that she would help them find the boy, but only if she could visit the Moors herself. It sounds like to me Myra wants a little day trip out of prison. Genuinely moved? I think not. On the 16th of December 1986, all roads onto the Moor was patrolled by 200 police officers. Apparently, Myra had difficulty connecting what she saw to her memories and complained that the helicopters flying overhead made her nervous. Myra insisted on wearing a balaclava and a bulletproof vest. And you can see everybody around her is like dressed the same. Like she thinks that like somebody's going to come and like sniper her. It's been like 20 years. Obviously people still fucking hate her guts, but what an attention seeker. The press described the visit as a fiasco, a publicity stunt, and a mindless waste of money. Nothing was found. A few months later, on the 10th of February 1987, Myra finally, formally confessed to her involvement in all five murders in a recorded statement that was 17 hours long. Girl is such an attention seeker. She loves it. I hate her. Ugh. She gave days, locations, and how she lured the children. Everything we covered in episode 2. But again, in Myra's telling of the events, she was never there when the children were raped or murdered. She was in the car, over the brow of the hill, in the kitchen, in the bathroom, looking out the window. It seems like she still thinks she can get away with this. Or like at least get out early sort of thing. Like the big, okay, time served. Because like she went in her early 20s. So she can get out in her 40s and have a good chunk of life left to serve. Live. Soon after, Winnie Johnson sends Myra a second letter. In it, she again pleads with Myra to help police find her missing son. In this letter, Winnie is sympathetic to Myra and tells her it's unfair the way the media portrays her. Now, see here, Myra never responded to the first letter, but she did respond to this second letter, which to me is interesting because if you look at the two letters, they're actually quite different. The first one is asking Myra to do the right thing, prove people wrong. It challenges Myra's ego and self-perception. But the second letter is a little bit softer. Winnie in the second letter is like, oh, it's unfair the way the media portrays you. I feel sorry for you. It must be awful. This agrees. It doesn't challenge Myra. It doesn't challenge her ego or self-perception. It is in line with how Myra perceives herself. As a good person who is being unfairly judged. Anyway, so Myra responds to Winnie Johnson and thanks her for both letters. So, get this. When Myra responds to Winnie, like writes back, she said that if Winnie Johnson had have wrote to Myra 14 years ago, Myra would have confessed then. And would have helped the police back then. Oh, I hate her so much. You, bitch, are victim blaming one of your victims. You're saying, oh, well, you know, you kind of caused this delay because you didn't write me. Oh, I hate her so much. Oh, she's such a bitch. Putting the moral obligation on Keith's mother. Fucking nut job. I have no time for this woman. She is a cunt. Myra made her second, third, and fourth visit to the Moors in March 1987. This time with even more security. And Myra even got to have a sleepover in the police chief's house. Over the next 3 days, Myra was able to narrow down the field of search, like the search area, and drew investigators a map of what she remembered. Although unable to locate either of the graves, she told police she remembered that as Pauline Reed was being buried, she had been sitting next to her on a patch of grass and could see the rocks of Holland Brown Knoll silhouetted against the night sky. Well, how fucking romantic. I hate her. In April of 1987, news of Myra's confession became public, and the country was divided on Myra's guilt or culpability. Myra made a public statement to the press, which touched on her reasons for denying her guilt initially. I think it was something like, I couldn't find the statement, but I think it was something like she was scared of Ian. But I don't really buy that. Myra also spoke about her religious reconnection to Catholicism in prison and all of the work and study and practice that she had been doing. And she also said, hey, look at me, I'm writing letters to Winnie Johnson. In this public statement, Myra also exonerated David Smith of any involvement in any of the murders, particularly Edward Evans, which everybody in Manchester was sure that David Smith had killed Edward Evans. Myra said she's seen no possibility of release because the public hated her so much. You see, even here, it's about her. Again, she's playing the victim and looking for attention. On the 1st of July, after more than 100 days of searching, investigators finally found Pauline Reid's body in a 3-foot grave, only 100 yards from where Leslie Ann had been found. In the bog, Pauline's body was found almost completely preserved, 25 years after she had been murdered. The teenager was still dressed in her pink and gold party dress she was wearing that night when she set off to a youth club dance. Pauline had received a violent blow to the head and her neck had been cut with such force that it broke the vertebrae. Pauline's family could finally put her to rest. Where is Ian Brady in all of this mess, you ask? Well, it seems that Ian was up for a wee hike also. 2 days after the discovery of Pauline Reid's body, police paid Ian a visit. They told Ian of Myra's confession and public appearances. And I think Ian got a little bit jealous. He deserved some of this newfound fame too. And maybe he would like to go for a hike and a day beyond the prison walls. He told the officers he too will help in the search of the moors again, but only if he can go. On the 3rd of July, Ian was also out on the moors, helping with the search for Keith Bennett. Ian said everything had changed so much. He couldn't remember where he had buried the body, so nothing was found. He was brought to the moors 6 weeks later, but again, nothing. In my opinion, this is totally 50-50. Obviously, the soft, hills and landscape can change. But also, he could just be lying. Ian has nothing to gain from finding these bodies. He is already serving multiple life sentences. He's not getting out of jail. And actually, he is quite happy in jail. Ian can only gain from not finding the bodies. He keeps getting this attention. He keeps getting the day trips. He keeps getting to wear regular people clothes. And it seemed that, like Myra, he enjoyed the attention. Because, after Keith's body was not found, Ian told a BBC reporter vague details of 5 additional deaths that he claimed he had been involved in. According to Ian, there was another unknown victim in the Saddleworth Moor, and a woman whose body he had allegedly dumped in the canal, a man in the Piccadilly area of Manchester, as well as 2 other men in Scotland. Dun, dun, dun! Of course, police had to investigate these alleged crimes, but there were no such unsolved crimes matching these descriptions. He was just making it up. When they spoke to Myra, she was like, I don't know anything about those, what are you talking about? But then saying that, she said that about the murder she did commit. So, okay, so I think this is appalling, so I wanted to include it. Like, this is not how justice is supposed to work. So Ian and Myra confessed to the additional murders of Pauline Reid and Keith Bennett. But the director of public prosecutions decided that nothing would be gained from a further trial, as both Ian and Myra were already serving life sentences. No further punishment could be inflicted. But I mean, like, they didn't get a whole life tariff. They got like, you know, that 25 to life. Like, they can still get out in 25 years. But even if, like, they did have a whole life tariff, I think it's just, like, justice to the victims and the victims' families that they get another sentencing for it. You know, it doesn't matter if they have five whole life tariffs, like, and they can never complete them. It's, like, just the justice for the victims, no? People are idiots. Since 1987, there have been multiple attempts to find Keith Bennett using new technology and new leads, but with no success, which is just so tragic for Mrs. Winnie Johnson, Keith's mom. Here is a picture of her in the moors with Peter Topping, the police officer leading the hunt for her son's body. After his conviction, Ian Brady seemed to accept his life sentence and settled into prison life and routine. In 1985, Ian was clinically diagnosed as a psychopath. He was promptly transferred to a high security hospital for the criminally insane. While here, he made it clear that he never wanted to be released. Ian seemed to keep relatively busy over the next few decades. He wrote a book, The Gate of Janus, and the UK public was horrified that Ian was profiting from serial killer stories, although he did not include his own. Ian also made friends with the teacup poisoner Graham Young, who I most definitely have to cover sometime. Not many men poison. Ian corresponded with journalists and had a great old time doing interviews. This part's kind of cool. For 20 years, Ian transcribed like old classical books into Braille until the Braille machine was taken off him. Like, they thought he might use it as a weapon. But he had it for 20 years. Like, he had plenty of opportunity. Why are you stopping him from doing something productive for society? Ian, who obviously can't drink alcohol or his German wine in prison, he offered up a kidney to donate to anyone who needed it. But he was barred from doing this. He was not allowed to do it. And it is hard to know if any of this stuff was like for genuine altruism, like, or was it all just for attention and control and manipulation? I mean, like, after all, he is a psychopath, clinically. And he just, like, hasn't turned over a new leaf. In 1991, Ian sent a letter to Alan Bennett, Keith Bennett's brother. Ian writes, "I again advise you to stop searching until matters are resolved. My will contains special instructions for you alone. My time is almost over. Sincerely, Ian Brady." My time is almost over. Are you Dracula? Also, his time was not almost over. He lived for 26 years after sending this letter. In 2005 and 2007, Ian taunted the Bennett family, offering to try and help find Keith Bennett, saying he knew where the boy was buried, and he would find Keith under one condition, that he be given the means to end his own life. Obviously, the UK does not have euthanasia, and they can't agree to this. We can't help you kill yourself. You can try on your own. Like, what? What, you want a guillotine? Ian apparently wanted to end his life for a while now. He had a paracetamol attempt and multiple starvation attempts. Although when he went to court demanding that he be allowed to starve himself to death and that he was on a 14-year hunger strike, the hospital security people were quite perplexed. They said, "We know that Ian sees us watching him make toast every morning. And in the evening, we give him soup and more toast, which he eats." The strike was not serious ideation, but rather just another protest to satisfy his pathological need for control and attention. But because Ian has a diagnosed mental disorder, the hospital was within their rights to, and did, force feed him more calories, which is why he has that feeding tube in his nose. Also, a 14-year hunger strike. Please, like, we know about hunger strikes and they do not last 14 years. At Ashworth Hospital on the 15th of May 2017, Ian Brady died of natural causes, aged 79. He was cremated without a ceremony and his ashes disposed of at night in the Irish Sea. Ew, get him out! According to those who knew him, Ian only regretted Myra's imprisonment and the consequences of their actions, but not actually the crimes themselves. Ian saw no point in making any kind of public apology or reparations. Just before his death, Ian asked for his two combination locked suitcases to be put in secure storage. Perhaps a one last fuck you to the Bennett family. After Ian's death, the police asked the court to order that two locked briefcases owned by Ian to be opened. Police argued that they might contain clues to the location of Keith's body. The application was denied on the grounds that no prosecution was likely to result from opening the suitcases. Again, this is such an insult to Keith and the Bennett family, in my opinion, who never did receive those special instructions from Ian Brady. Keith's family argue that clues to the whereabouts of Keith could be in the other suitcases. It's a damn suitcase. Just open it. Why are you protecting the privacy and the wishes of a dead, lying serial killer, pedophile, rapist? Why are you protecting his privacy? Who gives a f-? To this day, the suitcase is still in secure storage somewhere, unopened, assumingly. And this is the perfect segue into my next section, the aftermath. For a start, you cannot visit Ian and Myra's house. The house was pulled down in the 1980s. You know what I was thinking? Where was the granny in all of this? Like, was she not suspicious at all? Like, they were living with Myra's granny. Come on, granny. Despite his bravery, David Smith and Maureen were hounded due to their connection to the murderers. Unfortunately, David was jailed for attacking the leader of a gang who had threatened to hurt his family. Forced out of their home, their marriage broke up. David's prison sentence led him to a nervous breakdown and as a resolution to turn his life around. He subsequently moved to Ireland with his second wife Mary in the 1990s and lived in Galway at the time of his death. The man credited with stopping the Murs murders died in 2012, age 65, following a battle with cancer. On August 18th, 2012, finally at peace and reunited with her son, Keith, Winnie Johnson died after a lifelong but futile wish for Ian Brady's help to find her son's body buried in the Murs. I'm getting a little bit teary. It's so sad that she didn't get to find him. Okay, right. Okay, I hear you. You can see the little red line is near the end, and we haven't went into Myra Hindley's time in prison. Well, Myra had quite an interesting time in prison. Multiple interesting relationships and quite a few brushes with freedom. There's like so much to cover, it needs its own episode. So we're nearly finished. I hope you're enjoying it. So see you next week for sort of part 5. It's more just like a Myra episode. Check out the Patreon. There's a £1 tier now. And that's it. And thank you to all of the journalists who did all the legwork. I sat on my computer. My references and thanks are in the description. Slán.